Hi, everybody. I'm Sarah Mack. I'm a graduating master's student at the University of Maryland, College Park. I'm under the advisement of Dr. Martin Ravenhorst. I'm a wetland person, so I'm a little bit out of my topic, I would say. I think I got into this when the wet soil mineralogy was the topic of this session in the beginning of when they were hosting the organizing the SSSA conference. So I have a good audience here. I'm going to continue on and power through. You're going to listen to me because you're here. I'll be just talking about some of my master's work, trying to investigate why certain soils derived from red pear materials resist color change, even though you'd think that they'd be wet. So just to get us all up to speed, since this isn't a hydric soils meeting or anything like that, this research is basically embedded in the idea the need to delineate hydric soils is one of the three main components of federally regulated wetlands. Hydric soils, even though they have a specific definition, they're generally described as soils with morphological features that we can tell makes the soil wet. One of these features that you see in this picture to your right is the accumulation of organic matter toward the soil surface, as well as redox-induced color changes in the subsurface where iron oxides that normally color the soil become reduced and solubilized into these depleted zones, or they are reoxidized into these warm-colored areas as iron concentrations. These features in relative abundance or thickness relative to the soil surface are termed field indicators of hydric soils. And if the soil meets a certain indicator, you know that that meets the hydric definition and that soil is a component of a federally regulated wetland. In some cases, however, there are certain circumstances, even though you have the correct water table and reducing conditions, but the soil doesn't exactly look like it's wet. And that means you have an issue when you're trying to delineate these wetlands out in the field. You're not sure if it's well-drained or poorly drained. One of which instances are soils that are derived from certain red pear materials. This is a picture of one to your left. And essentially, these iron oxides that color the soil overall, they actually resist being reduced and solubilized into colorless forms, leaving this red color behind. Preliminary studies since the early 1990s has resulted in a methodology where you can distinguish between which red soils are resistant to this color change from red soils that are not. This procedure is called the color change propensity index, and essentially what it is you take a soil and synthetically reduce it in the lab with chemical reagents, measure the soil color over time, and calculate this based on the color change differences, the CCPI value that measures its resistance to change. In order for you to be this resistant to change material, you have to have a CCPI value less than 30. So in the spring of 2015, a national effort was coordinated between myself, the National Resource Conservation Service, the Corps of Engineers, and the Kellogg Soil Survey Lab at Lincoln, Nebraska, to essentially identify where all of these materials occur throughout the nation. You see it mapped in red. This map was generated by doing CCPI analyses of more than 1,200 individual soil samples from 500 sites, so I spent a lot of time doing this. But the main thing that you need to know is that all of these problematic color change resistant materials occur in soils that are really deep, dark red in color, and they're in association with sedimentary, hematite-rich red bed formations, what a geologist would call a red bed formation. A new indicator has been made called F21 red pear material to be used to identify and delineate wetlands that are impacted by these materials. So if you're interested in learning more about what the indicator is, what the color change frequency index actually does, I have a wetland, I have a poster in the wetland soils session today at 2:30. I'd be more than happy to discuss. Hopefully I'm interesting you in hydric soils and you'll come out and chat with me about it then. But overall, this talk is getting at why are these soils that resist color change, what is causing this phenomenon? And we look to explore three main hypotheses. The first one's looking more at the pedological kind of aspects of the soil, so physical occlusion of iron oxides within certain particle size fractions. I have a schematic in a later diagram in a later slide that will kind of demonstrate this concept a little better. The other two are looking more at mineralogical causes. As I said earlier, hematite's been the linking iron oxide pigment amongst all these materials that I've identified. So the first hypothesis is looking at aluminum substitution, actually in the crystal structure of hematite in soils that are resistant to color change. This hypothesis stems from some research done with goethite and oxisols, where aluminum for iron substitution was actually found to inhibit its reduction, even when it was wet. Does that occur to hematite in this case? And then the last hypothesis is looking at the actual crystal sizes of these hematites in these soils that are resistant to color change. And this is just from the general understanding that larger crystals tend to be more stable in the environment because they have lower surface area, that they have less reactable space with the environment to be transformed. So again, this is just the map I showed earlier. I had to collect a bunch of samples to run experiments on them. They're indicated in the black dots you can see. They're the color change resistant ones. I also have four non-resistant, non-problematic samples in blue. These samples were selected based on if I had a project collaborator that could get me enough of them, if they were representative of the paramaterials that derive them, and if they were assumed or believed to have the mineral hematite as the main pigmenting agent within them. So here is getting at my first hypothesis, the idea of physical occlusion. And what you're looking at is a series of four micrographs. On the left is a picture of a problematic color change resistant material, the very fine sand fraction under incident light. And then on the right, C and D are the coarse silt fractions under incident and transmitted light. And particularly on the left, these two A and B micrographs, you can see indicated with S on these little aggregates here. These are actually lithified fragments of shales that are coated with a thin veneer of iron oxide. So it's this idea that the iron is inaccessible to the microbes on the interior versus the exterior of that lithified aggregate. Is this causing this resistance to change overall? To explore this idea, what we decided to do was fractionate the samples further down from the clays into the very fine, medium, coarse silts and sands, and then analyze each of these fractions for their CCPI to see if one of them was more resistant to change than another. And interestingly, what you see here for this one sample is the clay fraction that does not have any of these lithified aggregates. They're individual particles in suspension. They remain resistant to color change even though they're not aggregated. So this says to me it's likely more the minerals that are associated with this clay fraction that's causing this. I did the same procedure for the rest of those 12 samples that I have the acronyms of the soil series on the x-axis and then the fraction that they are on the y-axis. And again, you can see for all these samples that are resistant to color change, the CCPI value is less than 30 and resistant to change. These are the four non-problematic and non-resistant to change, and the clays all have CCPI values greater than 30. So looking more at mineralogical causes is the reason why. So this moves me to my hypothesis about aluminum substitution, looking at hematite again, because that's the main pigmenting agent. And a paper done by Schwartman in 1979, he was able to determine that the amount of aluminum substitution in mole percentage is directly related to the size of the hematite crystal in the A dimension. And this makes a lot of sense intuitively because aluminum is a smaller ion than is iron. So as you increase that amount of aluminum, your hematite is actually going to shrink in size. That's what this diagram is showing here. The other great thing is this A-dimension space can actually be measured using X-ray diffraction for the hematite peak, at specifically the 300 peak at 64 degrees 2 theta. Here is a diffractogram that I ran of one sample that's resistant to color change, the same one I showed you in the micrograph earlier. This is the clay fraction of the sample where the iron oxide fraction had been concentrated by dissolving the silicate minerals in a 5-molar sodium hydroxide solution. The sample was also spiked with a highly crystalline lanthanum boride standard in order for you to align your diffractograms to the correct locations relative to the reference minerals where they're supposed to be. And the way you detect this A-dimension distance is the peak shift from hematite at this 300 peak to the right, where the more aluminum substitution, the more your peak shifts to the right, and you find that parameter, plug it into your Schwartman relationship, and you can determine how much mole percent of aluminum was in your hematite crystal. So this is the results of all of my problematic samples. And you can see here that essentially there's no aluminum substitution. The highest I have is 2%. The mean is about 1 out of the 15 total percentage that the hematite mineral actually tolerate. This is not a driving cause of this phenomenon. Lastly, the hypothesis, crystal size. So just a review, we know that crystal size impacts soil color. For hematite specifically, darker, more purple crystals tend to be larger, whereas brighter colored are smaller. Again, larger crystals are more stable. And then the shape of the peak in a general sense tells you how large or small your crystal is when you look at an X-ray diffractogram. The taller, more narrow, generally the larger the crystal. The smaller the broad, the shorter the broad, or the smaller the crystal. You can actually determine this in nanometers, which is called the Schirrer equation, and what you essentially do is find this full width at half maximum for that peak you're interested in, plug it into the equation, it'll give you the crystallite size of whatever mineral of interest you have. I did this for all of my samples at the 2.51D spacing for hematite. The problematic samples, the resistant ones are on the top with CCPI values less than 30. The non-problematic is on the bottom. And you can see that the problematic color change resistant materials are significantly different from those that are not resistant. Just to wrap it up, so physical occlusion is not a cause of this problematic nature. It's not causing, it's resistant to change. Aluminum substitution is not a large factor since there's barely any substitution in any of my samples. Crystal size is likely a main driver. The hematite was larger in the soils that are resistant versus those that are not. And then my final thing for, hopefully you'll come to the poster later, for the field indicator F21, the color requirements within it should reflect the colors that are associated with larger crystal sizes of hematite. I'd just like to thank the Corps of Engineers for funding me, my research committee, all of the undergrads helped me analyze all my samples, and then Sharon Waltman, a retired GIS specialist at the NRCS, for helping me make my maps. Is it? Hey, John.
Sarah, if we were able to measure crystal size then in the field, would that do away with the need to measure color change propensity index?
So that's basically what the maps I have are for. I'm basically trying to say show where these occur, so using that indicator is okay without you having to do the CCPI analysis. Luckily enough, the indicator that's already made now has darker values and lower chromas to indicate that they're darker purplish red in color, and that's more proof that, yeah, if you meet under that color requirement, you have to have those color requirements in order to be this material. So that's what's reflected by that hematite size. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mickey.
Mickey Ransom, Kansas State University. You have geologic formations in the same area that will vary in their crystalline sizes.
That's a really good question. I only know from making my maps. I'm learning more about their depositional environment and what relates them that way. I know that for most of the formations, hematite is the mineral that dominates most of them. What I could do is if I could get more samples of the actual rocks, I could grind them up and look at them that way. I'd have to individually go down each of the formations and look at them, and I have over thousands of them that I've essentially mapped with GIS, USGS data sets. So it doesn't really answer your question, but I know that hematite is the mineral. That's as far as I got.
I know they vary in color.
Yeah. Most of them are these dark red colors. Yeah, and that's become a challenge when I make the maps too, because the formations have different members and I'm just trying to lump them all into one thing. My only, advice I would give to somebody using this indicator is that you want them to be these really dark purplish red formations.
Alrighty, before we leave, I have a few announcements. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
So I